This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. It's been an oppressively hot and humid summer in much of the United States. For most of us, the heat is an annoyance, but it can be deadly, as the heat now gripping parts of Russia demonstrates. Our guest, historian Edward Cohn, has written a book about an intense heat wave that gripped New York City in 1896, which he says is one of the worst natural disasters in American history. It killed roughly 1,300 people, far more than the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. Cohn says the heat wave affected the career of Theodore Roosevelt, who was a police commissioner at the time. Edward Cohn is an assistant professor of American history and chair of the American Culture and Literature Department at Bilkent University in Ankara, Turkey. His book is called Hot Time in the Old Town, The Great Heat Wave of 1896 and the Making of Theodore Roosevelt. I asked him to begin with a reading from the book.
Heat waves are not like other disasters. Heat kills slowly, over days. It does not leave marks on the victim's body, nor does it destroy buildings or leave any physical evidence of its destructive force. There is no single moment when a heat wave strikes, no specific time allowing survivors to recall the moment when it began. Heat waves produce few dramatic photos or visual images like rubble and flames. Victims of heat can remain unaware that they are being slowly killed, suffocating alone in a closed, airless space. An assassin strikes quickly and flees, but heat lingers, remaining in the same room with its victim for days. The city itself becomes an accomplice to heat's murderous effects. Anyone who has ever lived in a city during extreme heat knows that cities bake their inhabitants in ways unknown to rural areas. In later years, this would become known as the urban heat island effect.
And that was our guest historian Edward Cohn reading from his new book about the 1896 heat wave in New York. It's called Hot Time in the Old Town. Well, Edward Cohn, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Dave.
I want to begin by talking a little bit about the housing and public health conditions in New York at the time. A lot of poor people lived in the city, a lot of immigrants. How dense were the neighborhoods these folks lived in?
Oh, yeah. These neighborhoods, small precincts would have perhaps 100,000 people. These tenements that most of the working poor, especially immigrants of New York, packed into on the Lower East Side. Basically, if it was a two-room tenement, that mean you'd have two families there, perhaps five, six people sharing a room. Sometimes even if there's a little extra space on the floor, the families would lease it out or rent it out to single men. It was so densely packed that, in fact, most people couldn't even live inside the tenement itself. And so the streets in front of tenements and the rooftops and the fire escapes were so filled with people all the time because really there was just, you know, no room for everybody to actually fit inside these tenements, and which were just, you know, squalid, suffocating, very little access to direct sunlight, air, or running water.
And talk a little bit about their structure, the building materials.
Yeah, these are basically made out of brick and stone, which is almost like, you know, these become, during the summertime, like, pizza brick ovens. I mean, the temperatures inside would easily reach 120 degrees. And so for an 1896, it's not just that, well, they don't have air conditioning and they don't have electric refrigeration. I mean, it really is both the working and living conditions that end up killing so many. This is also the time of, 10-hour work days, working 6 days a week, doing manual labor. Right? Most New Yorkers at the time aren't lawyers and stockbrokers. They're working with their hands out in the sun.
And in a fair number of cases, people actually were employed in their homes, right, doing piecework of one kind or another.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's a very common thing in New York at the time, rolling cigarettes, doing piecework like for textiles and tailoring, making little, paper flowers to sell on the street. You know, by 1896, it's also 3 years into a terrible economic depression that hits the Lower East Side terribly. There's thousands of people out of work, thousands of people homeless. And so you have this massive population in New York that's already living this marginal existence. And then you have a natural disaster like a 10-day heat wave. It just pushes thousands of them over the edge.
Did many of these dwellings have running water?
If they had running water, the most they had was perhaps a common sink in the hallway, something that was almost, shared by scores of people, always filthy, always stopped up, And if you're on the second or third floor during summertime when the water pressure drops throughout the city, probably you didn't have any water at all. Most of the tenement dwellers were getting their water from a common outdoor spigot. And so trying to stay hydrated, as we all try to do, you know, today, or just to keep yourself or your children or your apartment clean, I mean, this was a difficult full-time job unto itself.
And where did people go to the bathroom?
Well, people, again, they had either a common lavatory inside the tenement, but very frequently, some of the older ones you still had, it was very common to have outdoor latrines out in the back. And so on the one hand, New York in 1896, it's really this transitional city. I mean, it is this highly urbanized industrial part of the United States, you know, unlike anything else in North America. But, you know, so many parts of it, you still have people, you know, raising pigs and chickens in their backyards. You still have latrines. You still have people don't have access to, you know, running water, let alone bathtubs and showers. And it's exactly, I think, because it's this, you know, rapid immigration, urbanization, industrialization. New York is on the cusp of a new century, on a cusp of this, you know, massive change. And people like immigrant laborers living in tenements, you know, they really kind of fall through the cracks of what's taking place.
One more question. How did people bathe?
You got a bucket from that common spigot outside and you brought it upstairs and you had the family sit around it and you dipped a rag in, and that was a bath. I mean, you didn't actually sit in a bathtub. That's just an incredible luxury that only people of, you know, Theodore Roosevelt's ilk living in Gramercy Park could enjoy.
So the heat wave begins Tuesday, August 4th, lasts for 10 days. Give us a sense of the intensity of these conditions as compared to heat waves that people experience today.
I mean, this past summer, we've had quite a few heat waves, you know, 3 days, maybe 5 days. This was 10 days, 90 degrees at street level, 90% humidity, temperatures not even dropping at night. Sometimes the temperatures don't even drop below 90 degrees until well into the evening. No wind. So at night, there's just absolutely no relief whatsoever. And, you know, the official temperature sometimes says, well, it's 89, 90 degrees. But New Yorkers are going by the Herald Square thermometer in Herald Square, and the temperature is well into the 90s, close to 100, well over 100 in the sun every single day, 10 days straight.
And what are some of the things that happen to people living through that kind of heat and humidity in these conditions?
I mean, one of the simplest things that the New York City government could have done was to lift the ban on sleeping in parks during the night, so people could have gone to Central Park and tried to get a, you know, breath of fresh air. The city government didn't do that. And so one of the things that people did was they took to the rooftops and they took to the fire escapes trying to catch a breath of fresh air. And inevitably, somebody would fall asleep or get drunk, roll off the top of a five-story tenement, crash into the courtyard below, and be killed. You'd have children who would go to sleep on fire escapes and would fall off and break their legs or be killed. People would go down to the piers on the East River and try to sleep there out in the open and would roll into the river and drown. And so certainly it's not just people dying of heat stroke. There are all these other kind of bizarre ways that people meet death during the heat wave.
At the most basic level, physically, what would happen to people when they endure these conditions day after day?
Yeah, literally, their body starts breaking down. Your internal organs start shutting down one by one. And some of the manifestations of it are, you know, extreme headaches, extreme dehydration. There are stories of people just, you know, trying to drink gallons and gallons of water, trying to rehydrate themselves and stop feeling so thirsty. But by that time, they're so far into the heat stroke that there's really nothing to be done for them. The only things that the cures that they had was basically if you could get yourself to Bellevue Hospital, even though there was a shortage of ambulances to get you there, doctors could put you into an ice bath, wrap ice around your head, and try to quickly lower your temperature. But it's amazing that some of the doctors' reports and coroners' reports of the victims of the heat wave, when they measured the body temperature of the victims, their body temperature was registered at the time of death at 109 degrees, 110 degrees, even 111 degrees. And the human body is just not meant to live like that. So to preserve itself, one by one, your body organs start shutting down until you die.
You tell us that the mayor, William Strong, did almost nothing about the heat wave. Tell us what they should have done and whether they learned anything.
Yeah, on the one hand, you know, this is obviously – it's before the Progressive Era. It's decades before the New Deal, long time before Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. You know, there is no social safety net. This is complete laissez-faire government. Again, the United States is 3 years into a terrible depression, and all during those 3 years, every level of government, federal, state, city, people are government officials are constantly saying, well, of course it's not government's job to help the poor, to give food to the hungry. So on the one hand, it's hard to really fault the mayor and the city for not doing more because that's simply just not in the lexicon of Americans at the time. But I think there were simple things that could have been done. The first one, as I mentioned, you know, lift the ban on sleeping in parks. How many thousands, tens of thousands of people might have gotten a good night's rest and maybe had their bodies cool down a little bit if you had thrown open Central Park to people to sleep? Another thing that was done by the Commissioner of Public Works, the guy responsible for, you know, fixing the streets, he experimented a couple times with changing the work hours for his men to make sure that they weren't out there working in the, you know, the heat of the midday sun. And another thing that the Commissioner of Public Works championed, the idea of flushing the streets, basically having gangs of men going around with hoses, hooking them up to hydrants and spraying the searing asphalt in the Lower East Side and then bringing the temperature of the entire neighborhood down by a few degrees.
There were thousands of horses in New York City at the time. How did they fare in the heat?
Normally, even just during a normal day, you might have, you know, maybe a couple hundred horses drop dead on the streets. I mean, they just were pulling overloaded trolleys, overloaded carts. During the heat wave, thousands upon thousands of horses died. And if your horse died in the harness, what did you do? You just uncoupled your harness and moved your cart away, and you left the horse carcass there to rot in the street. The city does have an independent contractor that it pays each year to remove the horse carcasses, but there's just absolutely no way he can keep up with just, you know, this terrible tragedy. And so by the end of the heat wave, probably on every city block, there's a rotting, you know, festering horse carcass lying on, you know, the steaming asphalt, you know, just rotting in the sun, adding this real kind of flavor of pestilence and actually adding a whole new, you know, threat of a health crisis.
And how did the coroners of New York deal with the human loss of life?
I mean, they were just completely overworked. It's really not that big of an office. And if a doctor, if you weren't in a doctor's care at the time of your death, you had to leave the body where it died, not move it, not bury it, and wait for a coroner to come and inspect the body and the circumstances of the death. And this, during the heat wave, this meant that, you know, these several coroner's officers were crisscrossing the city during, you know, this terrible heat wave, climbing stairs to the tenements, trying to deal with this, you know, huge load, this caseload. And, you know, there were cases where the coroner's clerks became heat prostrated, trying to keep up with filing all the death certificates during the heat wave. At one point near the end of the heat wave, the coroner actually asked the mayor if he could suspend the rule, saying that, well, you can't move or, you know, get ready for the body to be interned until a coroner comes and checks the body, because this would mean, you know, literally that a dead body in this heat might be sitting in a tenement where the temperatures are 120 degrees for 2 or 3 days before a coroner could finally catch up with the caseload and come to inspect the body.
You say that in this circumstance, ice, which was produced, was a precious, life-saving commodity. Where did anybody get ice in 1896?
Yeah, the ice is basically either harvested from rivers or from lakes, and it's stored. You know, it's packed in hay and straw, and so it's actually stored even to be distributed in August during heat waves. And by 1896, this summer, something new has happened in New York City. An ice magnet by the name of Charles Morse, an ice baron, has come down from Maine, and he has actually consolidated about three-quarters of the independent ice companies into a single consolidated ice company, basically an ice trust. And so long before the summer, people are already worried that he's going to jack up the price of ice, make it essentially a luxury for some of the poorest New Yorkers, and people will die as a result. And this is exactly what happened. I mean, there's no electric refrigeration. You have a tin-lined, zinc-lined wooden box, and you put a big chunk of ice inside it. That's how you keep food and milk from spoiling in such heat. Most New Yorkers, poor New Yorkers, simply can't afford it.
So when it was clear that the heat was serious and destructive and life-threatening, were there efforts made to make ice more readily available?
Absolutely. And one of the in a time when the city did virtually nothing, the mayor didn't even call an emergency meeting of his department heads until the last day, the 10th day of the heat wave. I do think that one of the heroes that emerges from this heat wave is Police Commissioner Theodore Roosevelt. He is not the police chief. He is one of a four-man oversight committee of the police department to make sure that promotions and hiring and firings are based on merit and not on, you know, politics and who you know. And he's only 5 years away from the White House. And in many ways, this is a very innocuous position to hold. But he is the one who champions the idea of the city giving away free ice to the poorest people living in the Lower East Side, in the tenement districts. And he personally supervises the distribution of ice. And I think one of the things that most impressed me was after the ice was distributed, Roosevelt took it upon himself to tour the back alleys of some of the worst tenement districts in the United States, in New York, to see how people were using the ice. And so Roosevelt witnessed firsthand how, you know, immigrant fathers would chip off a piece of ice, give it to their children to suck on. Mothers would wrap a piece of ice in a handkerchief and tie it around the heads of their sick children. And I can't think how many American presidents have had such intimate contact with the urban poor. So absolutely, I think this is part of the making of Theodore Roosevelt, the progressive president that he'll become.
He's an interesting figure, of course. I mean, he was born as a privileged New Yorker, had at that point run unsuccessfully for mayor, right? But someone who had long been interested in the difficulties of urban life and efforts at reform.
Absolutely. I think this Western mythology of Roosevelt as somehow a cowboy and a man of the West is really misleading and overblown, that somehow really the source of his domestic policies and foreign policies as president derived from these couple of years he spent on his Dakota cattle ranch. Roosevelt was a New Yorker. He was born into one of the most wealthy New York old Knickerbocker native stock families. He was Harvard educated. And he was an urban reformer. His origins are in urban New York urban politics.
And did he become more popular? Was he recognized for his efforts in distributing ice?
No, not really. I mean, this is by the summer of 1896, Roosevelt's career in New York City is really at an end. He's not a very popular person. In his early years, he launched a crusade against having saloons open on Sundays, which made him very unpopular with Germans, with Irish, with a lot of the exact immigrant poor that he's trying to help with ice distribution. And, you know, the people in the Lower East Side, they weren't going to be voting for a Republican Roosevelt anyway. By the summer of 1896, you know, Roosevelt is not doing the ice distribution to get votes. And really what he's doing is he's pinning his hopes on a McKinley victory that fall and a new position in Washington, D.C. So this isn't something that, you know, it's not the making of Theodore Roosevelt in that it puts votes in his pockets and catapults him into the White House. I think it's the making of Theodore Roosevelt is that it helps make him the progressive and one of the dominant figures of the progressive era.
Well, Edward Cohn, it's been interesting. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Edward Cohn's book is called Hot Time in the Old Town, The Great Heat Wave of 1896 and the Making of Theodore Roosevelt. You can read an excerpt at our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. We were saddened to hear about the death of historian and essayist Tony Judd. It was only 5 months ago that Judd appeared on Fresh Air to talk about his struggle with the neuromuscular disease ALS. Tony Judd died on Friday at the age of 62. He led a distinguished career as an academic historian. His 2005 book, Post-War, A History of Europe Since 1945, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Reviewer Alan Ryan said it had the pace of a thriller and the scope of an encyclopedia. Judd was born in East London in 1948 and grew up in a secular Jewish home. As a young man, he spent time in Israel and became a passionate Zionist. But he later changed his views about Zionism and wrote essays sharply criticizing the State of Israel and American foreign policy. In the last months of his life, Judd wrote personal essays about his illness and his memories. He described ALS as progressive imprisonment without parole. First, he wrote, you lose the use of a digit or two, then one limb, then almost inevitably all four. When Terry spoke to him in March, he was effectively quadriplegic. His voice needed an amplifier, and he was attached to a pump that assisted his breathing. Because, he explained, his diaphragm was no longer strong enough to handle the task alone. He spoke to Terry from his home in Manhattan.
Tony Judd, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you for doing this. I know it takes a lot of effort for you to do an interview now, and I appreciate you making the effort to talk with us.
Thank you for inviting me on the program.
I really like what you've been writing about having ALS, and it's like you're functioning as a reporter, telling us what you're experiencing and what you're thinking. One thing you haven't been doing is offering life lessons. Are people expecting life lessons from you?
Gosh, I've no idea. I mean, I think my answer to that question is this. It's a bit like, if you'll allow me the analogy, which is a bit of a stretch, it's a bit like what Primo Levi wrote about his experience of Auschwitz, which is to say that however terrible it was, that whatever he did to survive it, he doesn't believe there's any larger lesson or moral story to be learned from it, because when you are hit by something as bad as the concentration camp, you survive, and there's no lesson to be taught about surviving except how to do it. In my case, I survive quite comfortably at one level, because this is one of the worst disease you could imagine, but it has no pain. So you have a lot of time in your untroubled head to think out of body, so to speak, about the reasons why the body doesn't work, the implications of being immobile for hours on end. I think the only life experience that I have to offer out of this is something we all know in the abstract but don't experience in practice very much. That is that you can survive an awful lot of bad stuff so long as your mind is intact. I'm afraid that's the only life experience I have to offer.
Well, your mind is intact, and you have such a sharp, agile mind. is it sometimes dangerous to turn your mind onto the subject of your body because your body is so fragile and non-functional now?
I think it would be if I were a very depressed sort of personality type. But what it does to me is make me angry. Angry, not at anyone, of course, but just at fate. And so long as I'm angry, I'm productive. Because I look at the body with some sense of detachment and say, you've let me down. I can't do this, I can't do that. And so what can I do? I think, well, I can still boss people around. I can still write, admittedly, with the help of an assistant. I can still read, I can still eat, and I can still have very strong views. But what it does do is mean that you mustn't. And I would give the same advice to anyone in any remotely similar disease. You mustn't focus on what you can't do. If you sit around and think, I wish I could walk, then you'll just be miserable. But if you sit around and think, what's the next piece I'm going to write? Then you may not be happy, but you certainly won't wallow in misery. And so it's an active choice every day to renew my interest in something that my head can do, so I don't think about the body.
Your wife is a dance critic.
That's right.
So her life is about watching perfectly tuned, strong, flexible bodies moving in ways that most normal human beings couldn't possibly conceive of moving. So can you enjoy watching dance now?
Well, I can enjoy watching my wife. So I imagine okay. That the answer is yes, by extension. I remember when we got married. We got married in 1993, and many of the guests were ballet dancers, because, of course, Jennifer knew many. And I remember thinking, you know, we can't dance at this wedding. I'll look like an idiot. I mean, this is full of people who are world-famous ballet dancers. And so I was hesitant to dance. Then someone said, look, it's because you're just clunky Tony that they are professional ballet dancers. So it doesn't matter. No one's going to laugh at you for not being them. Everyone's going to look at them and say, boy, they're gorgeous. They won't even notice you. And in a way, that's how it is now. I can't be physical in the way that my wife is physical, or indeed my kids are physical, or most of my wife's friends are physical. But I so much can't be it that it doesn't hurt.
You know, many people, when afflicted with a disabling disease, turn away from God. You were brought up in a secular Jewish home.
That's right.
And you remained secular. So has being sick changed any of your personal views about religion?
No, but the no is very straightforward. I don't believe in an afterlife. I don't believe in a single or indeed multiple Godhead. I respect people who do, but I don't believe it myself. But there's a big but which enters in here. I'm much more conscious than I ever was, for obvious reasons, of what it will mean to people left behind once I'm dead. It won't mean anything to me, but it'll mean a lot to them. And it's important for them, by which I mean my children or my wife or my close friends, that some spirit of me is in a positive vein present in their lives, in their heads, in their imaginings, and so on. So in one curious way, I've come to believe in the afterlife as a place where I still have moral responsibilities, just as I do in this life, except that I can only exercise them before I get there. Once I'm there, it'll be too late. So no God, no organized religion, but a developing sense that there's something bigger than the world we live in, including after we die, that we have responsibilities in that world.
Are you talking about memory here, about acting in a responsible way so that memories your loved one have of you will be good ones?
Well, I'm certainly talking about that. That is absolutely true. But I think it's something slightly different. The risk with something like ALS, where you sit on a wheelchair all day, where you're looked after by professional nurses, because it's way beyond anything your family could do, where you live in one space, your back room, while other members of the family live their normal lives and you encourage them to, the risk is not that you do mean or bad things. It's that they lose a sense of your presence, that you stop being omnipresent in their lives. And of course, to the extent that you are present, you're surrounded by nurses' equipment, a sort of smell of a hospital, so to speak. So it seems to be my responsibility, particularly to my children, but also to my wife and friends. It's not to be Pollyanna and pretend everything's okay. No one would take me seriously if I said that. But it's to be as present in their lives now as I can be, so that in years to come, they don't feel either guilty or bad that my having been left out of their lives, that they feel still a very strong, not a memory of particular actions, but a memory of a complete family rather than a broken one. That seems to be something I can do or try to do.
Now, you've written extensively over the years about European history. You've written about the European left. Now that your body is immobile and your physical world has shrunk, does history matter to you as much?
Yes, I think it does. I know that sounds funny, but it really does. I believe that the reason is this, that all I ever wanted to do in life, professionally, occupationally, was teach history and read and write it. You know, there are times I've thought, my God, you're a dull man, Jut. You know, since the age of 13, you've wanted the same thing, and now you're 62 and you still want it. But the upside of that is that I get as angry at bad history writing or the abuse of history for political purposes as I ever did. I think, however, probably that I am more also, not instead of, but also focused on where we go now than I was 10 years ago. You know, 10 years ago, I might, whatever it was, I might be criticizing Clinton or Bush or Blair for some ridiculous policy. But it was very much in the sort of the sense of that I'm doing what I can do, which is to write about politics in the public space. But I think now I'm more worried about the future. The past is always going to be a mess. It's going to be a mess because it was a mess, and because people are going to abuse it, get it wrong, and so on. But I'm reasonably confident that with each generation of historians, we keep fighting hard to get it right again. But we could get the future very seriously wrong, and there it's much harder to get it right.
Is that why your new book, Ill Fares the Land, is in a way a letter to young people about applying the past to the future?
Well, it's absolutely and deliberately a letter to young people, though it's not written down at all. And I would hope that a young person aged 60 would want to read it. But it's about not forgetting the past, about having the courage to look at the present and see its faults without walking away in disgust or skepticism. It's about believing. I been teaching for 40 years now. I'm encountering the first generation of young people that colleges and schools really do not believe in the future, who don't think not just that things will get evidently and permanently better, but who feel that something has gone very badly wrong, that they can't quite put their finger on, but that it's going to spoil the world that they're growing up into. And whether it's climate change or political cynicism or overreaction or lack of reaction to external challenges, whether it's terrorism or poverty, the sense that it's all gone out of control, that they, the politicians and so on, media people, are neither doing anything nor telling us the truth. That sense seems to have pervaded a younger generation in ways that were not true in my experience. Maybe the last time that might have been true was in the 1920s, where you had the combination of shock and anger from World War I, the beginnings of economic depression, and a terrifying realization that there might very well be a World War II. I don't think we're on the edge of World War III or IV or anything, but I do think that we are on the edge of a terrifying world. That's why I wrote the book.
You compare that in your book to the attitude of young people in the 60s. You compare this sense of helplessness that you think a lot of young people have today to the 60s, and you say, back in the era of self-assured radical dogma, young people were far from uncertain. The characteristic tone of the 60s was that of overweening confidence. We knew just how to fix the world. It was this note of unmerited arrogance that partly accounts for the reactionary backlash that followed. Do you feel that you shared in that sense of confidence and arrogance?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think I would have felt comfortable writing that if I had been either born earlier or later, because it would have sounded smug and a bit sanctimonious, an outsider, you know, dumping on the 60s and so on. But in practice, that's my generation. I grew up with the idea that you only had to worry about ideas and change, because things like jobs, things like physical security, could all be taken for granted. And that's, I think, a common Western position in those years. So that we had the luxury of sitting in comfortable colleges or with parents who would support us if the time came to it, looking at the world and saying, it's terrible, we must change everything and we know how. There was the residue of Marxism, which was still very much alive, kicking in the 60s, but in the worst possible sense, in that Marxists were now young people, with the exception of a few old people, who thought that, well, the West was a lost cause, liberalism was a fraud, the proletariat disappeared, so let's focus on blacks or colonial minority victims or someone outside ourselves. So we never looked hard at ourselves to ask what was wrong with our own society.
So was there a particular dogma or philosophy that you felt you became, that you feel now in retrospect, that you were overzealous and overconfident about?
Well, in my case, there were two. I think most of my contemporaries were bound up to a greater or lesser extent with what they thought of as Marxism, the revolutionary critique of capitalism, changing the world in China or Cambodia or Africa or whatever it might be. I shared some of that coming out of an East European self-taught Jewish Marxist background. Both of my parents left school at 13, my grandfather's as well. But my particular form of ideological overinvestment came with Israel. I went to live on a kibbutz. And I idealized the world of collective agrarian work where everyone was equal, everyone contributed, that all this awful European intellectual stuff just fell away. And I didn't realize at the time that I was completely blinded by this. I didn't see an Arab, didn't speak to one, even though I lived in Israel right next door to them. I believed profoundly in Zionism in the way that my contemporaries believed profoundly in Maoism or Castroism or whatever. It took a while for me to break clear of that.
You decided in the past few years that you think that Israel should actually be one state with the Palestinian territories, and that in one state everybody should have an equal vote, which really outraged a lot of your readers, because right, it would mean Israel would cease to be a Jewish state and the majority voting population would be Palestinian. So what was it like for you to alienate so many of your readers, to outrage?
Well,
so
it was, I mean, my wife, who is not Jewish, was amazed. She said, but why can't people see how reasonable your essay was? I said, look, what I did was break outside of a very big circle, the circle of Jews who believe in Israel, and speaking as a Jew, stood outside it and said, the emperor has no clothes. And that is not calculated to please people. But I would say, by the way, that although I made a lot of enemies, some of whom probably still see themselves as my enemy, they were nearly all in the United States. My essay was republished all over the world, an essay on what was called the alternative to the present situation. In Israel, this aroused a lot of critical commentary, but also a lot of approving commentary.
being sick now, how has your taste for being controversial been affected? I mean, it's nice when you're sick to be, you know, admired and comforted.
Right. Well, of course, you know, I still get admired and comforted by people either who never read the New York Review or else who don't see anything wrong with what I wrote. But you're absolutely right. You know, people don't stop being angry with you if you say things that provoke them just because you're in a wheelchair. I think most of them don't know I am. But I would like to backtrack, Terry, and say that I don't think I'm a controversialist. In fact, as I was thinking about this when someone asked me, I've only ever published 4 little essays in a lifetime of book writing and lecturing and teaching. Just 4 little essays which touch controversially on painful bits of other people's anatomies, so to speak. 2 of them were about Israel. 1 of them in 1979 was a critique of the silliness of modern history writings. That nearly lost me tenure at Berkeley. It certainly made me a few enemies there too. But apart from that and the essays on Israel, I've written thousands of pages of depressingly uncontroversial, boring history books, or written about foreign policy or other stuff. I think if I'm controversial, it's not because I set out to be. It's because I've never felt comfortable being part of someone else's mainstream community. I'm not in the middle of the left, even though I'm on the left. I'm certainly not part of a Jewish world, even though I've never been ashamed of being Jewish. I'm actually rather proud of it. I've never been English, even though I grew up there. So I always feel myself a little bit marginal. That the marginalia that I'm on isn't affected by the illness. I would like everyone to love me who wouldn't. But you don't want to be loved for the wrong things.
We've talked a little bit about what you find most productive and what takes your mind off of your physical inability now. What gives you pleasure?
Well, how risky and personal would you let me be?
Give me a shot.
Okay, all right. The thing about ALS is that there are only 2 things left beyond your head which still work. One is the reproductive apparatus, then the other is the excretory apparatus, to be made blunt. Then you keep those till you die. So you still get pleasure from sex, and you can still get pleasure from anything you can see, anything you can say, and although this may not last much longer, anything you could eat. So it's sometimes I think, well, listen, all the good things of life, midlife, are still with me. Sex, food, videotapes, I've got it all. What's the problem? The only thing that I miss that I can't reproduce is travel. I can pretty much do anything else, but I can't travel very easily. And I miss that terribly because I was a person who moved all the time, whose history writing was based on what I saw in strange, exotic places rather than just reading books. So I miss that, but all the other pleasures, to a greater or lesser extent, are still open to me.
You know, you had referred to this earlier, but you wrote, I should be at least mildly satisfied to know that I have found within myself the sort of survival mechanism that most normal people only read about in accounts of natural disasters or isolation cells. And you're talking here about your ability to cope with the ALS.
That's correct, yep.
And your entrapment in your immobile body. Had you always asked yourself if you had that survival mechanism?
No, I don't think I did. I think I knew in myself that I could do, as an exercise in willpower, anything that I wanted, but it would be about willpower rather than survival techniques or special skills, none of which I have. But I do recall, and it's kind of eerie thought, that when I first read Franz Kafka's Metamorphoses, thinking for many years as a child, teenager, what would it be like to wake up in your bed as a cockroach? What would your parents say? What would your wife say? Would they run away? Would they pretend it wasn't happening? How would you handle it? And between that and the sense I always had that Lou Gehrig's disease was something terrible I ought to know more about, because, of course, I'm interested in baseball and my kids are. I had a kind of, not premonition, but a sense that of all the diseases that I might end up with, this would be the worst, because it would be a challenge to my relationships with the outside world. I could live in my head, that's easy. But dealing with people when you're in a wheelchair and a quadriplegic, it's very hard, because you spend your time putting them at ease rather than they spending their time putting you at ease. And so I think the answer to your question is that I had no conception of what was about to hit me. I wasn't prepared for it. That's a new stage in life. You wouldn't ask for it, but you've got to face it and do something.
Tony Judd, I really want to thank you so much for talking with us. I appreciate it greatly.
Well, thank you for having me.
And I wish you the best. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Historian Tony Judd speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in March. Judd died Friday of complications from ALS. He was 62. You can hear the entire interview and see video of Judd talking about living with his illness at our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.